Hey, Damian Mason here with a question before we hop into this episode of The Business of Agriculture. If you farm for a living, you employ a lot of amazing technology, from your inputs that you put into the soil to the tractor that you sit in, your combine, the amazing data that it harvests. But has your soil analytics kept up technologically with everything else in your farming operation? I would venture to say that no, it is not. Sure, you check for your nitrogen, your phosphorus, your potassium, your micronutrients as well. But what about disease pressure? Do you know what diseases and what pests you're going to face next year? No, you don't. But you can now figure that out with Pattern Ag's predictive analytics. Think about it. They can tell you now with testing what the likelihood of facing nasty diseases, things like cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome, what the likelihood of you having this in your field. Then you know how to prepare, how to treat, and where to invest your money. It's using technology to make you bigger yields and therefore make you bigger money. Go to www.pattern.ag to learn more. They are pioneering the way in predictive agronomy. Let me guess, you're from a farming background and you have a story about a farm family that imploded because of arguing over how the estate was going to work, how the farm was going to work, what sibling was going to farm, who was going to get what. How did I predict that? Because I've been around this industry my entire life. And you know what? It seems like we all have those stories. Some of us even grew up with that story. That's the subject today. We're talking about the family farm and the dynamic of farming with family as a business. Hey there, Damian Mason coming at you for this episode of The Business of Agriculture, and I've got a great guest for you today. I've got Andy Cajun Junk, and Andy sent me a book. I actually didn't know about this guy, and I checked it out. I won't say that I've read the entire book, but I definitely skimmed through it, and I found enough hot topics in here. I'm like, yep, I can relate to that. Yep, I've seen that. Oh, yeah, I know that story. Anyway, Bulletproof Your Farm is one of his books, and he says, hey, I want to come on your podcast and talk about this thing. Stubborn. So actually, that's what he calls his business, stubborn.farm. And you know what's interesting, Andy? What we all know, if we've been around it and we're old enough and mature enough to understand, it's the emotion and it is a personal issue that's not generally a business issue that causes all the strife, but it's always a thing where they don't handle the business like they should. So as we know, we call this the Business of Agriculture podcast because agriculture is a business. And if you want a lifestyle and you want a legacy and you want that family farm, fourth generation, sixth generation, whatever that thing is, you better handle the business first. And a lot of that means the legal business, the partnership business. And that's why you're on here today. So anyway, quick background on you. You're a Canadian guy that's now settled in Iowa.
Yeah. Basically, I'm a seventh generation farm boy. And, 25 years ago, I would have said all this, what I'm about to talk to you about is a bunch of BS. But I've been through a lot of BS myself, with my own family. The year I came home from college, my dad and I had a dispute about how we were going to farm. And so I got my field and he got his fields. And my uncle made an offhand comment that your boy's fields look better than yours. And my dad plowed down my crops mid-season. And nobody in the county could understand why. And essentially, I've been, my parents actually ended up getting a divorce over a manure spreader after they had a fight after that. Essentially, my mom said, do not buy another piece of equipment until you sat down with your son and written a business plan. Because the day I left for college, my mother, she actually showed me the farm financials. We hadn't made money for several years. And she said, if you don't fix these numbers, I'm going to leave your father. So I was under the gun to try to make changes, but my dad was actually very reluctant to make any changes. And things happened in our family. A lot of changes happened. My parents got divorced. The farm's no longer viable. And what caused our family to be successful for seven generations and farming that stony ground up in Bob Cajun is the fact they were stubborn. And what caused us to fail is the fact that we're stubborn.
And yeah, what's interesting about that is, and I mean, everybody that's listening to this, and I don't care if you're 20, if you are 20 and you haven't already seen a story like this, then you need to get out more. And if you're our age, you've seen it time and time and time again. First off, by the way, no offense, but your dad's an asshole. He destroyed his son's crop out of envy. He destroyed his son's crops out of envy, and he couldn't stand the fact that someone complimented his son. So you know what? He's a dick. I can say that. But you knew that already, didn't you?
Well, I would say, looking back 20 years later, I was an asshole too. And I think that's the problem we have is, you know, the biggest lesson I had, I started mediating about 10, back in 2010. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing this pretty close to 15 years now, as a full-time occupation. You know, there was basically what happens in marriage counseling, everybody goes to see the marriage counselor and at least half those people are divorced within 4 years. And that's because they go in with the attitude, I want your opinion. Am I right to leave this person or not? I want you to point blame in my partner, but I'm not willing to make changes myself.
Yes. In other words, they don't go there to actually be fixed. They go there to be affirmed.
Exactly. And that's what I firmly believe. Like back in my 20s, I thought exactly what you said. But the thing is, there was actually a day. So I was mediating, and what would happen would be I'd sit at the end of the kitchen table and I'd broker a deal where somebody would say, if you change this, 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 then I'll change that. Well, essentially that never worked out. And I was seeing about half the cases that I was working with were failing and I couldn't understand why. And until I found out that statistic about the marriage counseling, then it just completely clicked. And the way we're doing marriage counseling, the way we're doing mediation is just completely broken.
Yep.
And there was this kid one day when I just shortly after I found out this fact, I was looking out the window. And there was this kid, and he was leading a 4-H calf. And that kid got up at 6 o'clock, at 4 o'clock every morning to go out and milk cows before he got on the school bus. And he couldn't wait to get off the school bus to go home and farm. That kid lived and breathed farming. And he wanted to be a farmer so badly. And yet his dad and his uncle were at the kitchen table with the two wives, and they were at each other's throats. And they had me out there not to actually resolve their issues, but to blame each other.
Yeah.
And they just wanted a divorce. And I thought, I looked at that kid and he was leading his 4-H calf and the calf was being stubborn. And what's 4-H all about to you, Damon?
Well, it's supposed to be about learn by doing.
And it's about character development, right?
Yeah, right.
And here we get our kids into 4-H saying about the farm being a challenge to become a better person. And the farm was bringing out the best in that kid. But here at the kitchen table, it was bringing out the worst in his aunt and his uncles. And his mom and dad.
Yeah, I want to get into a bunch of those things, Andy. Before I do, it's interesting because I know that there's people saying, well, you know, I'm listening to this and I can relate. Your background, probably not from a very well-held background, kind of like me. There was some farm. There wasn't much to go back to. I mean, there was nothing for me to go back to. But it's in my blood. And, you know, I've got a farm gene. There's nine kids in my family. Three of us have a farm gene. The other ones, I've got sisters that wouldn't know a Holstein from a soybean. I mean, they just, you know, but anyway, so you've got the farm gene. You went to University of Guelph, which is the ag school in Ontario, ag business. And so your plan was to come back and farm. And you were kind of given an ultimatum from your mother. Hey, things are terrible here. Come back and fix it. That's a pretty big burden to stick on a 22-year-old.
It is what it is. But, I mean, the thing is that the first white man killed in the township was on the back end of our farm back in 1832. And he was my relative. Mm-hmm. And I always grew up believing he died so that I could have the right to farm.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up as a kid during the 80s farm crisis, basically, the year I left for college, 18 of the farms sold all their cows. Everybody was getting out, and they were always saying how it was a shame that none of your cousins are going home to farm. So I thought it was my right to go home and carry on a seven-generation family tradition. If I wanted to step up and carry on tradition, it was there. But what I found out was nobody has a right to farm. It's a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we get in the mindset of entitlement, and that's what kills farms. Like in that situation where I was talking about the kid leading the 4-H calf, everybody felt entitled to each other's love. Everybody felt entitled that the farm was going to continue for generations. The truth is, if those two brothers broke up the farm, that kid would be put into so much debt that he would have to be paying for the rest of his life to buy out his uncle, that he would never be able to grow and never be able to expand. There would be a point in time when the dairy price would hit a rock bottom low that kid could not cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I was looking out that window and thinking, how terrible is this situation that kid has no future because the Eagles, it was more important to be right. And as a result, things weren't going to be right on that farm for that kid. And then I looked over and there was a Bible. This is a Christian family. And they had a Bible at the kitchen table. And I don't care if you're religious or if you're Protestant, Catholic, or you believe Elvis is still alive and you're atheist. I don't care. The thing is, it said Matthew 7:5 was right beside me. It said, do not take the speck of dust out of your brother's eye until you've taken the plank out of your own. And that for me just changed my whole perspective on everything, because that's a magic solution for successful marriages, successful partnerships, is we got to stop pointing fingers at each other, and we got to start looking the three fingers pointing back at us. Mm-hmm. We got to stop being stubborn with each other, and we got to start being stubborn at the habits that make you more successful, turning weaknesses from weaknesses into strengths. And that's the basic premise. I've gone from being a mediator to trying to get rid of the need for a mediator altogether.
I want to hear about some of your stories, and also we're going to get to some of the big ones here, because you sent me a note, and I said, here's the things I like to talk about most. The succession, sure. Business plans and farming are useless. I love that one, because I've been very, very big about business plans being way overrated. And then about dealing with the change of hands. And then the other one, of course, is mental health issues. And I want to go through those. But before I do, I want to ask you this. 2010, you helped mediate a farm conflict. You turned this into your business. How? Were you sitting? Were you out there? You know what? How? Just tell me the process of getting here, because you're now a service provider in agriculture doing something that is greatly needed. That many farming operations, to your point, are so stubborn they will never seek the help they need, or they seek the help to a firm, like you said, like the marriage counselor. So how'd you get into this? And then I want to go from there.
Well, for the guys driving tractor right now, just take a step back, because we're going to be here for a while, but I'd love to tell you. There was a moment for me where I almost hung myself. I basically said, by my birthday, we have to get a succession plan in place, or else I'm going to hang myself. And I put the ultimatum there. My dad was a narcissist, and he didn't really care. They didn't take my ultimatum seriously. So I found myself on my birthday sitting on a barn beam with a rope around my neck and a .22 in my lap. And I walked into that barn only thinking about myself and how I was hard done by. Mm-hmm. And basically what had happened is when your parents get divorced over a manure spreader, mm-hmm. basically one day the shit hit the fan, right? And so that's kind of a funny joke. I mean, I said it offhand one friend in confidence and became gossip in five counties.
Yeah.
And so basically everybody that went to University of Guelph with me, I had a lot of friends, heard the story. It was part of the reputation, I guess you say. And so basically over the 10-year period that I was trying to struggle, go home on the farm and join the farm and fix my parents' marriage, you know, I became the guy that everybody had started to have a beer with. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was that in that process, I started stepping in and just found I had a natural gift for mediating. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was I ran a country bar called Raging Cajuns. The country bar was named after me on weekends. And I sat in the University of Guelph library for several years studying to become the expert in succession planning. And then 2010, I opened the office and was on the radio station, put a big, you know, launch. I'd helped about 15 families up to that point. But the first real client that was not a friend was a farmer. We'll call him Jack. That's not his real name. But he was actually from Western Ontario, and he had just gotten in a fight with his son. And essentially there was a 22-year-old son. He was 27, and he had come home from college with a bunch of ideas. And his dream was to double the size of the dairy herd from 60 cows to 120 cow barn. Mm-hmm. And basically dad said, I had agreed to sit down with the bank to talk about an expansion. What dad did not know was that as actually the fifth meeting that the son had with the banker, all dad had to do was sign on the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And somebody called an hour before that meeting the first meeting was supposed to happen. And son and dad went from being best friends to worst enemies. And basically, dad was so insulted that he had spent his entire life to give the farm to his kid on a silver platter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't perfect, but it was there because he had made some good decisions. And yet, it wasn't good enough for his son. And he felt his son was looking him a gift horse in the mouth. Mm-hmm. And basically, every suggestion the son had for change after that moment was perceived by the old man as a criticism of past management decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I suddenly understood what was going on with my dad and I, is that, you know, when young lads come home from college, they got a ton of ideas, but at some point in time, these suggestions for change are seen as criticism of past management decisions. And for somebody who's the center of identity is being a good farmer, yeah, it really hurts, mm-hmm, because that's your pride. And soon dad, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, starts to push back on these ideas and double down on bad decisions, because it's more important to be right in a conversation than for things to be right. Mm-hmm. And that creates a very wrong situation. And the first client I had back in 2010, when I went full time into this, he called me up on Sunday morning. So I've sat down with Jack, we'll call him, on the Saturday, sat down with his son on a tailgate, had a beer just before milking. Monday morning, we're supposed to sort things out, because they already had, gifted equity to the son. He had 30% of the $10 million farm by the age of 27. But, you know, the son had actually wanted to buy dad completely out because he was tired of dad micromanaging him. Mm-hmm. And dad was only 57.
Yeah.
And he had said when the son was in college that he was going to quit 5 years after the kid came home.
And he didn't. But, and now he was reneging on what he had promised.
Exactly. Well, the thing is that we don't understand, and this, they don't teach this at college, and nobody realizes it. The biggest change in technology is the fact that fewer farmers have bad hips at the age of 60. They go on for hip surgery, whereas back in the 60s, if you had bad hips, you'd retire. Nowadays, dads are going in for hip surgery, and they're farming to their 80s and 90s. And if you want to farm to the day you die, I'm all about making that happen. But the conundrum we have is that instead of there being one generation farming at a time, we got three, if not four generations farming together. And because the equity required to farm successfully, you need so much capital, it doesn't make sense every every 25 years to be splitting up capital between siblings. Mm-hmm. So you got to keep it all together. So you got suddenly a situation where you got three generations farming together, three, four siblings farming together. You got a situation where there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians.
That's, by the way, something I'm going to get into, because I've seen that time and time again. It's like, you know, there's only so much to go around. Hey, farmers, we're talking to you, obviously, about this, but we're also talking about anybody in agriculture. And yeah, a lot of what we do here on the Business of Agriculture podcast is we seek answers and we seek ideas and we seek information. That's why we got guys like Andy on here. I want you to think about this. There are countless apps that you could use, but let's be real. You probably don't need half of the apps that are on your phone. Do you even know how to use all the apps? Let me tell you about an app you will use. AgVisor Pro. It's the one app you cannot afford to miss out on, because it can actually help you save money. Remember, Rob Syke, the founder of AgVisor Pro, says if you shorten time and distance, it makes you money. If you're spending time looking for answers in agriculture, why don't you just put the app? It's real easy. I'm holding it up right now, my smartphone. Just go on your phone and go to your app store and put AgVisor Pro on there. It's a bunch of other ag people on there, some who have expertise, like, for instance, Andy right here, who has this expertise in mediating farm disputes. He could have the app on his phone. He could be listed as an AgVisor, as a agricultural mediator for disputes and succession planning. You see how it works? So put AgVisor Pro on your phone. Maybe you don't know how to eradicate some invasive species of weed. Somebody on AgVisor Pro has dealt with it and can help you shorten your learning curve. You don't want to take my word for it? How about hearing from my buddy, Mackenzie Fingerhut, a farmer from Alberta, Canada?
We were sitting on the fence about booking the rest of our fertilizer, but after one quick session with Mo Agostino, that really just kind of gave us the kick that we needed to finalize the rest of our booking. In a week or so, the price rallied 100, 200 bucks a ton and subsequently saved us over $70,000.
All right, there you have it, AgVisor Pro. Okay, back to my man, Andy Junkin. So your first client, 2010, professional client, when you actually quit your job, started this business, and you had already walked away from the farm and said, that's it, I'm done. Or were you still doing some, trying to do some farm on the side?
By that time, we were done.
It was done.
Sadly.
So this was,
I mean, that, and I think that's what made the difference that day, is that because what happened was I was sitting in church when the farmer called me on Sunday morning, and I had just gotten a cell phone because I was, this is 2010, and I thought anybody that carried a cell phone was a yuppie. And so I held out, and then I realized halfway on the third ring and sitting in church that it was my phone. So I went to hit the off button, and I actually hit the speakerphone. And I threw it back in my suit pocket. Well, I got it all mixed up, and everybody could hear. It went on speakerphone. I guess it was a volume of 10, because you could see the little old lady in the back pew had heard what he just said. And he, excuse me for cussing, but this is exactly what Jack said. He said his name, and then he said, "If you don't want some goddamn sense of this asshole son of mine, I've got a rifle and I'm going to use myself and nobody else." And that was my first client.
So it was a success story. He didn't kill himself.
No, and that's how I got the reputation for turning around dire situations, because everybody in that church, it was actually Christian Reformed Church in Stratford, Ontario, which was a lot of farmers in that congregation.
Yep.
And you know what I realized when I threw the gun in the trunk was all that book knowledge I had about succession planning, who gets what, how to avoid paying taxes, is absolutely useless. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a whole level. That's what I spent my life dedicated. I've gotten up at 4 o'clock every morning ever since then, because that's when Jack got out of bed every day to milk cows. That's when I get up and I try to read 100 pages every day, trying to figure out how to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. And what it came down to was, you know, the way we're doing succession planning is just completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And we gotta, before you can sit down and talk about, I mean, the concept of dad passing over the torch and then retiring, that's gone. Those days are gone. We're gonna have 3-4 generations farming together. And you gotta figure out how do you have multiple generations, multiple siblings work together as a team. How do we, and so we're all working towards the same goals. So it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
What matters is we make the right decisions together and we create heaven on earth.
Andy, I agree about the succession, because it's generally, I mean, there's so many farm situations, and it's always the same thing. The farm that begrudges the more successful farming operation down the road, and you know these people. Yeah, well, they're agribusiness. You know, and I'm like, yeah, they also have a lawyer set up all their stuff. It's all handled. What's yours? Well, I just always been saying, like, you've been hanging out in the shop talking to your bumpkin buddy about, well, you know, when I die, I do this. I'm like, that's not a legal arrangement. That is not succession. That is not anything that would ever be business. Any business would never handle things that way, nor should they. So I find that to be very true. The other thing that you said, though, I actually want to disagree with. You said that we're going to have people farming until they're 80. That's been the thing forever. Farm until you can, you know, and that's that thing. You know, I want to go out there, I'll die on a tractor or whatever. I actually believe that from about my age on down, I'm in, you know, mid 50s. I think that that's not necessarily the case. I think that that I see folks that want to actually do some other things. You know, we talk a lot about, oh, during the pandemic, people decided they kind of enjoyed being home with their dog, or they kind of enjoyed doing this. I'm wondering if it's not a pandemic thing, but I'm just wondering if in the last decade, we've seen a little bit of a shift where some of these folks that say, yeah, I don't know if I want to be out here doing this when I'm 80. I really kind of almost think that we're going to start seeing a shift in that. It means I'm disagreeing with you. Not that we're going to have a problem with disagreeing, but I think there might be less of that. However, there's still going to be two generations involved, because that's the way it's always been. It's that thing that, you know, kid comes home from school, whatever, and he or she joins the operation. I just don't know that they're going to be around until they're 80. I think that they might walk. I predict that that's going to become a thing.
Well, I think that some farms, some guys, they want to retire and they want to go play golf in Florida or golf in Arizona. And you have a place down in Arizona. And you know those guys, right? But I do think
a bunch of them are Canadian too, Andy. What is the deal?
I think you guys got to figure it all out. I don't know why the hell we moved to Iowa instead of moving to Arizona. That's what me and my wife complain about in February every year. But anyways, the thing is that I think there is always going to be, there's going to be some people that farming is a career. And as soon as they're done the career, they can't wait to retire. And then there's some people that being a farmer is who they are. And they would rather give up their left nut than ownership of the home farm. And they want to farm until 3 days after they die. Yeah. And, you know, if you're one of those guys, I want to help you make that happen. But, I mean, I had a situation just 2 days ago where a guy's 77 and, you know, the same situation. I mean, basically he and his nephew and his son cannot make decisions together. And it was creating a situation where they basically had a pissing contest over every decision. And it was creating skyrocketing mental health issues, as well as the farm wasn't profitable because, you know, it became more important as to who is right and who is wrong. And as a result, everything was wrong in that situation. And that's what I really focus on is how do you get multiple generations, multiple siblings making decisions together? And so what I start off with is having a family business meeting once a month where the son and the daughter or whoever's involved in the operation comes to the table. And you know, what I found was that there was a granddaughter and, you know, she got really upset because she came on the farm. She took over the dairy herd. They had to buy a new milk tank because she did such a good job in the barn. But then when it came to year end, they made so much profit that they had to reinvest back in the farm. She had no say into that. And she had done a research as to doing a new calf barn ventilation, but she gave the researcher to her grandpa. Grandpa didn't even read it because he seen it as criticism because he had built that calf barn. Mm-hmm. And he seen it as criticism at what he had done. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that when granddaughter suggests something, grandpa's got his arms closed. Mm-hmm. And what you want to do is have a family business meeting once a month where it's not just granddaughter coming to the table and suggesting new ideas to improve the farm, but grandpa in 5 minutes later is going to do the same thing. And so through that process, we see it as process of brainstorming, ways to improve the efficiency of the farm, just as far as how we work together and production matters, not criticizing what's been done. And that you got to, where we get into problems in succession planning is that you'd be surprised by this, Damon. 77% of farms do not have a succession plan.
Yeah.
77%. But I would tell you that you would think it's the small Mickey Mouse farms that don't have a succession plan. It is the largest operations. I've been on 13,000, 20,000 acre operations. And, you know, as one guy says, you know, they can fight about when I'm gone. Why do I care? You know, they're not thinking about why would you spend your 40 years building up a farm if it's going to be gone 40 years down the road?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, you talked about, being suicidal. And yeah. Here's the thing. You leave. Frankly, it's the easy way out. You make it so that then your wife, your husband, your kid has to see you with your head blown off. You think that doesn't screw them up for the rest of their entire life? Well, think about it this way. It's about the same way that guy that says they can fight about it when I'm gone. Oh, boy, congratulations. Instead of you making a couple of difficult decisions and doing some work, you made it so that you now left a wake of disaster. Because this is the same thing. My parents were terrible business people, not business people at all.
Yeah.
And didn't handle anything the way it should have been handled. And so this then you leave this thing so that now, like me, the business-minded kid tries to steer it in the right direction. And then I've got to be now resented by this sibling and hated by this sibling, the non-ag people that don't even get it. You know what? So I say the guy that says, oh, they can fight about when I'm gone. What do I care? You're a dick. You know what? Why you're gonna leave it instead of, it's just like blowing your head off. You just made it so that now you've given a burden to the next generation. You know, if you really feel that way, just sell everything. Just sell everything right now. I mean, because clearly.
Yep. When I was about to hang myself, I was clearly narcissistic. I accused my dad of being narcissistic. I was a narcissist as well, right? I was only thinking about myself. It was only in that 2 minutes before I was about to hang myself that I started thinking about other people. And that's actually what motivated me. I haven't been back to Bob Cajun ever since. My goal is I want to go back and spread my boys to spread my ashes there. But between now and then, I want to help as many farms as possible. But coming back to that issue about narcissism, whether it's an 85-year-old refusing to do a will and estate planning, or if it's a 20 guy in his 30s, just thinking about himself and nobody else, the root issue we have in farming is that we're narcissistic. And it's an easy trap to fall into when you're the boss, when you have a bunch of employees that answer to you. When it's your job to shape the world around you by using your hands and getting people to do what you wanted them to do, it's really easy to fall in the narcissistic trap. There's actually a study done in England back in 2017. They found that lawyers and farmers are the highest degree of narcissism. And what I'm really focused on is in order to fix the root issues of agriculture, we got to stop thinking of, in terms of me, and we got to start thinking in terms of we. And when we sit down and make decisions together, it doesn't matter me coming in a meeting and trying to get my way and bully my way into getting things done on the farm. It's a matter of us looking at five different ways we can do things and weighing the pros and cons and actually listening to the other guy's ideas. And so it becomes more important to be right. And as a result, things then to be right in an argument. And then if you can do that on small production related decisions, or even how you manage your time during the course of a week, then sitting down and do succession planning is an afternoon conversation. But if you cannot listen to each other's ideas, if you have everybody that's narcissistic, only seeing things from their perspective, that's why 77% of farms do not have a succession plan. And I've read 37 books last year on narcissism, and I have become the leading expert in narcissism in North America, not just for ag, but outside of that. That's my next book, is I'm writing on that. But we got to shift our mindset from me to we. And that's the first thing, that you got to fix a stubborn first in order before we start doing succession plan.
You know, it's not just ag people. There's all kinds of folks that don't handle their affairs the way they should. It's just that the one that strikes you more is, this is something that we always talk about, the legacy, the lifestyle, the family, for crying out loud, any critic of agriculture from outside tries to talk about preserving the family farm. And we're no better than the critic out here that, you know, goes to Whole Foods and complains about modern agriculture if we're not doing the preserving of the family farm ourselves.
I think a lot of folks that I know are very honest people. They're just not honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, a lot of farmers that I meet them on days when they're saying one thing and then doing another. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of them realizing, seeing themselves in the mirror and becoming the person that they know that they can be. And that's a big thing since that moment when I was on that farm where the kid was leading the 4-H calf, and we got realizing that instead of pointing fingers, we got to look at the three fingers pointing back at us. Mm-hmm. What I do is there's two basic things I do with a farm. Well, three, actually. One is I get the family making good decisions together, so it doesn't matter who's right, who's wrong. We're making the right decisions together. The second thing is I look at, for every challenge you have in life, you got either an incorrect belief, a character flaw, or a skill deficiency. And every month, I want every family member to make one improvement in their character, right? Either or one of those three categories. An incorrect belief might be, say your son and daughter, they come to the barn, but they come to the barn 15 minutes late. Mm-hmm. Well, you give feedback to your son. Hey, if you want to be part of this operation in the long term, you got to show up on time, man. You got to be the first one here, last one to leave, if you want to be partner in this business, right? There might be a character flaw, such as the way he turns a molehill into a mountain, right? There might be a skill deficiency in that he's passive aggressive, and he needs to speak up instead of blowing up about things after the fact, right? Each month, if you can make one of those changes in the character, and you do that over 24 months, you've got a different successor. And you've taken a successor that has potential to realize the full potential. And I've been in a lot of succession deals where the parents are in later years and there's a real hesitation. Can the son and daughter manage this operation? Mm-hmm. And what I think is really important up front is to take a successor in the early 20s from having potential to realizing their full potential. And if you can make one improvement in character every month, you'll have a successor that anybody, whether they're relative or non-relative, would want to invest in and be a partner with.
Is one of the problems, Andy, that, well, there's a couple. I've seen situations where parents piss away what grandpa and grandma did because they coddle the next generation. That's as bad as the guy you talked about that was mad that his kid had such big aspirations.
Yes.
The worst one is when your kid has zero aspirations and, you know, it's that old thing. First generation makes it, second generation keeps it, third generation blows it. You know,
that's a real deal.
Oh, definitely. I'm sure that. And you probably have been in situations where you've had to say, hey, you know what, folks, your kid's a screw up. And you're not holding them to any level of responsibility. You've been in those situations?
Oh, I've been there and plenty. And when in those situations, it's not just the kid's fault. I mean, if the kid has been told no all for 20 years and has basically a controlling narcissistic father that doesn't let him make decisions, at some point in time, the son's not going to be willing to stick out his neck and be in a vulnerable spot. So basically what I have is something that I call the 9,000 hour rule. And basically my premise is that the son and daughter comes home on the farm. We got to determine how many hours is expected to be put in this operation if you want to be a potential partner, not just earn beer money on weekends by milking cows a couple of times so that, you know, and have a different career. If you really want farming as a long-term career, you know, state how many hours we expect you to work. And the average farm I work with was about 3,000 hours a year, right? So it's what I call the 3,000 hour year. For 3 years, you got to put in 3,000 hours a year. And each month or each quarter, depending on the farm, you know, we go through this process of continuous improvement where we give feedback to the son and daughter as to character improvement. And after 9 days, if you said to your son, look, you got to start showing up at the barn on time. Mm-hmm. After 9 days, he's had three months that he hasn't done that, made that character improvement. Then we got to ask ourselves, we got to make a statement. You got to be this tall and get on the ride. And if you're not willing to make a change in your character and improve yourself and realize your full potential, then nobody wants to be partnering with you. And I think the thing is, but at the same time,
they never do. But you see, Andy, the things that I'm talking about is they never say you got to be this tall to ride.
Well, that is the problem.
You've got to show up, you know, you've got to treat this as a business because then it's like, well, and so it's always this coddling. And by the way, then when you hear, and this is where I'm a little bit different than most of the young people, because then you'll hear somebody, well, it's just so sad that family farm wasn't able to make it because of large corporate agriculture. I'm like, no, it didn't make it because Junior over here had no responsibility, no work ethic, an entitlement mentality. And you know what? I don't feel bad for him. In fact, I'm gonna go to the auction, try and buy the ground because I do look at this as a business. He didn't. And so I'm a little different. Like, I don't pull the whole poor them. I'm this is a business.
On you got to have a time and place, whether it's once a month, once a quarter, you guys decide where you give feedback to your son in a written format, and then you give performance evaluations every month as to how he's doing. And then if he isn't this tall to get on the ride, then we have a discussion. Okay, Junior, what is your passion? Because there's a lot of kids that come home to farm to please their parents.
That's right.
And they're living mom and dad's dream. They're not living their own.
There's no question, because there is that pressure. And I'm not being mean to, you know, a kid that's irresponsible, I am being mean to. But there's a lot of thing where it's like, oh, well, there's this pressure. You're supposed to do this.
Yeah.
And I admire agricultural operators that say, you know what? I saw somebody in South Dakota years ago. It was that way. It's like, I got two sons. One's, you know, a chef. He's like, how the hell are you going to be a chef in rural Northwest South Dakota? And he's like, I get it. So he's like, yeah, they're not going to be back here. I admire that more than you know, like you were told, you better come home and fix this. Well, that's a lot of obligation put on a kid. By the way, we were going to cover a whole bunch of other topics, but let's.
Before we go any further than that, though, there's two things. Is that what I'm really concerned about is there being critical feedback in a functional format, because often I see sons and daughters where they're home and they get nothing. They hear nothing but negative criticism. And what we've got to do is filter that down to one meeting a month where the kid can walk away from that meeting with one thing that he knows he has to work on. And then what I want him to do every day.
Or she.
Absolutely. When she puts on her boots to go out to the barn in the morning, I want her to write I want her to work on three things every month. I want her to adapt one new thing and work on that for 90 days. I want her to write that out. And at night, when she comes in from the barn, I want her to give herself a score A to F. Like, was I passive aggressive today, or am I proactively talking about problems before they happen? No. And then vice versa, after 1 year of the son and daughter doing this process, I want the parent for year two and year number three to go through the same process. Mm-hmm. Because just because the kid's in his 20s, you say that, you know, friends of yours are 57, want to go to Arizona, that's great. But, you know, what I want to do is, just because you have a multi-million dollar farm if you're going to be a jerk to work with, you know, it ain't worth the stress and mental health for a successor. So you've got, you as a parent have to become the partner and friend anybody wouldn't want to work with. And that means you have to change a few incorrect beliefs. You have to change a few character flaws. And you have to change a few skill deficiencies in order to be a partner that anybody want to work with into their 80s. Because the dark secret about succession planning, and this is the dark secret, there's 77% of farms do not have a succession plan. Of the 23% that do, half, at least half, are a hostile takeover. And that's because the sons, dad's in his 70s, the sons are tired of being micromanaged because of a few character flaws, like, for instance, the dad's passive aggressive. Sons get frustrated or the daughters get frustrated and say, dad, we're buying you out. And, you know, there's somebody might have a lifetime lease in the farm, but they're looking out at a shop and they're not welcome in the shop. And that is, there's some people that are like you that want to go to Arizona and can't wait to do that. There's a lot of men, they want to die with their boots on.
Yeah.
And that is a dark secret. There's a lot of guys, they would love to die with their boots on, they die with their slippers on. And what we got to do is stop having the sense of entitlement is what you're talking about, Damon. The sense of entitlement as far as a kid coming home and they're not being this tall to get on the ride. And also parents just being jerks to work with. We got to all have a sense, stop getting the sense of entitlement. You know, nobody gets married expecting to get a divorce. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes home to farm with their family expecting there's going to be problems. And the root issue that I found out as far as marriage counseling, coming back to what I was talking about before, is our sense of entitlement that the other person has to change. I don't have to change. And what we got to fix on the family farm is everybody's got to continuously improve themselves in order to create an environment anybody would want to work on for the next 30 years.
One of the observations I have made is that, and you know, we've talked about the entitled kid or the irresponsibility or whatever, and then it becomes this thing about, well, this damn next generation. And I always kind of pull back. I'm like, let's talk about you. Let's talk about you.
Yeah.
I think there's and you're the one that's out here doing this, but my perception is it's more of the operator in place than it is the younger generation. That's my observation. And like you talk about people hanging around, there's a joke in my community. I know of a guy, he's like at least 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
And he hasn't really made a farming decision in his life. And
yeah, there is.
His old man. And like, at some point, you need to either say, hey, listen, I'm 40, whatever, 35. I'm a grown up.
Yeah.
It's time for, you know, that. And so there's that. But I think that I would probably say the problems are more with the existing generation than the assuming generation. Is that accurate?
I would say, here's my thoughts, is that in succession planning, everybody's focused on transferring assets, who gets what, how, why paying taxes. That's just a false belief, because you're going to have probably, you should have three generations. I believe after the kid's been home for 9,000 hours, they prove themselves to be this tall to get on the ride. There should be a clear cut plan as to, okay, if I work here for the next 30 years, how am I going to earn equity in a growing business? If I could take it from being a $5 million farm and take it to being worth $20 million, what percentage of that is mine? And what percentage is to my sister who's in California who hasn't set foot on the farm for 20 years? Mm-hmm. And that has to be clearly on. There's a lot of guys in your age, Damien, in their 50s that do not own the house they live in. They don't own the truck they drive. They have tripled the size of the farm. And they suddenly find out after a funeral that they have to buy out their non-farming siblings who haven't been there for 40 years. Yeah. And that's because there's been a false belief by grandpa that it's all mine, that narcissistic mindset.
Yeah.
And what we got to do, I mean, what kills a lot of farms is it's pretty hard to get out of bed in your 30s and 40s to go fix a combine if you don't know if you're going to have to buy that on a estate sale from the neighbors. And so what you talk about mental health and you talk about depression, that is a root issue that's causing a skyrocketing crisis.
You talk, and Andy, about the narcissism. I want to throw this out there and Jolene Brown tells a story about this. The guy that dropped dead, he was like a 58, whatever, my age or so, 60, 55, 53, whatever, somewhere in his 50s, early 60s, who finds out when his parents die that, like you said, the operation is four times the size that it was when he was there. And he's got to now pay, you know, three siblings who haven't been around for 40 years. He's got to pay them. So essentially all he did was, and he doesn't have hardly any, he's got 25% and his income wasn't there. And so, you know what? Shame on them though. Again, this is a business why weren't you at age 25 saying, hey, I'm here working. What is in this for me? And then, of course, your statement might be, they get lied to. So we've seen that all the time. Well, yeah, we got you all set up. We got you taken care of. And then that son of a bitch that dies didn't take care of anything. You know, it's okay. It's going to be split 20. It's going to be split four ways. Well, that doesn't do you any good. You've got very little income and your only asset is your 25%. You probably can't even buy out the siblings.
This is the insanity of succession planning. We're basing it the way we do succession planning based on English common law back in the 17th century. Farming has changed since the 17th century, but the way we do succession planning hasn't. Like Steve Jobs and Wozniak, they started their Apple computers out of a garage, but they didn't take it to be a billion-dollar company themselves. They had managers. And when those managers proved themselves, they started giving them stock options. Yeah. And I think that after your son and daughter have been home for three years or so, and they've proven that they're this tall, get on a ride, they're a competent manager that a non-relative would invest in them and want to take them on as a partner, there should be a clear-cut business strategy. And that's all succession planning is a business strategy as to the long-term growth of the business and also equity split. And there should be a clear-cut plan as to, if I put my shoulder into this for the next 30 years, what percentage is the opportunity for me to take over? And if my sister from California has a problem with that strategy, great, come home and work 9,000 hours on this farm. Prove that you're competent as well, and we'll make a figure out a way for you to earn equity in the growth of the business as well. But that, I mean, it's clearly, Steve Jobs, nobody that would be a manager at Apple Computers wouldn't be Apple Computers if all the managers were there working for just a wage.
Yeah.
The only reason why they got out of bed and they had that drive to grow it is because they're earning options. Yeah. And what's causing a skyrocketing amount of divorces for guys in the 30s and 40s is that their spouses are saying, hey, you're 35. We haven't had a succession plan in 15 years. Mm-hmm. Either I'm leaving this farm in January. If we don't have a succession strategy, you can come with me or not. Mm-hmm. And that is putting a lot of sons and daughters between a rock and hard place, choosing between the farm and their spouses, because their spouses say, this is nonsense that we're putting in 4,000 hours into a business where we're getting paid $30,000 a year. This is insane.
And by the way, we always call them the non-farming outlaws, the in-laws, the outlaws. But the reality is, if you're married to some, let's say, dude, that's more common. Let's say you're a woman that's married to some dude and you're not from the farming background. And then, you're out here living in rural America, rural Canada. And you see your husband leave at 6 a.m. and get home at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And at some point you're going to say, what's our deal? You know, what's the actual arrangement? And again, I think your advice and my advice is treat this like a business.
Yeah.
It's like, well, no, we're not Apple. We're a farm. It's a business.
Yeah. Yeah. I would totally. I mean, so I think after the kid's been home for 9,000 hours, there should be the talk, mm-hmm. right? But before we have the talk, let's make sure we can all sit down, make decisions together. So we're able, succession and strategic planning, whether it's a barn expansion or doing succession planning, that's a complex decision. And we got to be able to make complex decisions. So I always liken it to making, when I was a kid, I was in Boy Scouts. Actually, my kids just came back from Scouts just a few months ago. And they have, the Boy Scout leader said, okay, you boys go build a fire. And me and my cousin went and got a biggest log, and it was a big old wet log. And we tried to light fire with that. Yep. And the Boy Scout leader then showed us, hey, you got to start with the kindling first. And what I think is, to liken that to decision-making, you got to get the family being able to make small decisions first without egos being involved. Like, I would rather have a successor and a grandparent have an argument about how can we make better use of our time so we're more efficient with our time. If we're all about to spend 60 hours in this farm in the next week, that's 180 hours. How can we better utilize our 180 hours and have an argument between grandpa and grandson as to what the priorities are on Thursday afternoon. So we learn to respect each other's decisions. So then when we talk about where the farm's going to be in 10 years' time, not just 10 hours from now, it's not a pissing contest. We got to stop being stubborn with each other. We got to start being stubborn at listening to each other. And we got to start being stubborn at adapting habits that will make the farm and the farm family successful.
I think we're going to leave it right there. Yeah, I think we're going to leave it right there. Good discussion. And by the way, we got other stuff we never even got to. Andy has a big point about business plans and farming and how useless they are. He has another thing about mental health. Obviously, he's already touched on that about his own issues. And we've also talked about how to successfully partner. We can do that on a future episode.
Love to do that.
Yeah, and if you have comments, dear listener, go ahead and put them in here. This is something that's very emotional. And by the way, if we sound like we're insensitive, it's because you know what? We've seen it. And almost I guess I lose tolerance. And I've seen it. I grew up with it. I dealt with it myself in my own family situation. And now there's, siblings don't talk to me. and it just goes on. So I've seen it. We've lived it. So if I sound short on it, it's more that I'm just intolerant. And also I find it inexcusable. I find it inexcusable because it's managing business. And I think that you would agree with that. So anyway, come back and we can revisit this topic in a year. If you've got comments, put them in the comments, send me an email, whatever you'd like. If you want to find out more, how do they find you, Andy?
Just go to www.stubborn.farm and I'll send you a free copy of my book, Bulletproof Your Farm, if you'd like.
Stubborn.farm, www.stubborn.farm. His name's Andy Cajun Junkin. I appreciate you being here, buddy. Big topic, by the way, share this with somebody that can benefit from it. Remember also, if you just listen to podcasts, this is also a great video. It's on my YouTube channel, the Damian Mason channel. I would really like you to subscribe there. It don't cost nothing. And I just am looking to build my subscriptions on my YouTube channel. So hit subscribe. And if you also want to check out the video, it's on Acres TV. We've been streaming over there since the beginning of the year. And it's working out very well over there. So Acres TV, YouTube, or where you get your audio podcast. Thanks for being here. Till next time, he's Andy. My name is Damian Mason, and this is The Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.